Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on bluechipspeakersnapa.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker tonight, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, "Yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing." Our speaker tonight is from the 7:30 a.m. early morning study group. I just met him a little while ago, and the great thing, it's just cool, you know, when somebody shows up and they bring friends, they bring people from their home group, you know, it's like a little traveling fan club, and that's the great thing about AA, you know, you got friends wherever you go. You show up somewhere, people will come with you, you know, make you feel at home, and you got new friends that you haven't met yet. So with that, let's give a big welcome for Dwight H.
I'm Dwight, and I'm an alcoholic. That's how I normally introduce myself. Special occasions like telling my story. I had this, by the grace of God, as shown to me through this program, I have not found it necessary to take a drink today. Nor have I had to since September 16th, 1980. And for that, I'm truly grateful. It's a miracle, trust me. And when I say God's grace through this program, that's what I mean, because when you hear my story, you'll realize that I've always been looking for God. I've been looking to fill that God-shaped hole in me. And I mean, I'm a preacher's son. I'm a preacher's grandson. And I studied religions and I experienced some, but I could never make that connection before I came in here. I could read Black Elk saying that the Great Spirit is within you. Or I could read the Bible and say the kingdom of God is within, and it didn't connect to me. But the great reality deep within us, that one connected to me, and that one saved my life. Because that was the spirituality I could use and I could grow. And now I can understand those other things. So, as I tell my story tonight, I'm going to mention things other than alcohol that I've been addicted to. And I don't intend to focus on them, but, when you shot up speed as a teenager, I think you really ought to mention it in your story. Yeah, but I'm not going to dwell on it because it's just a symptom like alcohol, and I respect what the policy is here. I would like to point out that in Bill's story, he talks about the next day found me drinking gin and sedative. And that combination soon put me on the rocks. People feared for my sanity, and so did I. And Dr. Bob spent years self-medicating and avoiding the morning drink by using sedatives. And I'm going to tell you a couple of stories about how spirit reacts, how spirit and I interact. And part of what the first one. I'm a denizen of the 7:30, and this subject came up, and I said, and I was annoyed because in the fourth edition they changed the name of Dr. Alcoholic Addict, and so I pointed this out, and I said I think they didn't need to get rid of the addict, and so I'm going on and on, and the next person who shares, who's a friend of mine, he very gently said, "Didn't they change the name of that to acceptance as the answer?" And I said, "Well, yes, they did." And the other story is, after I had about 12 years in the program, I finally realized that the line in the book that said never belittle the services of a good doctor or psychiatrist could actually refer to me. And I got into therapy. And I had a therapy session once where the therapist was talking to me about black and white thinking. I don't know why. And as I was coming home from that session, I was walking through little Five Points and with all those houses with all those ornate sidewalks, and I couldn't have pets where I was living at the time, and there was these three cats, and they're right beside the sidewalk. There was a solid black cat and a solid white cat. So I sat down and they came up to me and they're purring, and it was really nice. I was really happy. There was a gray cat in the background that would not have a thing to do with me. So I don't remember the therapy session, but I remember that. And if you didn't like those two stories, you're probably not going to like the rest of this talk at all. Yeah, I'm sorry. So what it was like, I wanted to read this to make sure I got it right. What it was like. I'm going to read a little bit because this describes me to a T before I came in. We were having trouble with personal relationships. We couldn't control our emotional natures. We were a prey to misery and depression. We couldn't make a living. We had a feeling of uselessness. We were full of fear. We were unhappy. We couldn't seem to be any real help to other people. That just nailed me when I came in. That and pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. And so I'm just going to add some details about my life, but that's what I was like. I was raised in small towns in Arkansas in the northwest corner. And when I was born so pigeon-toed that I wouldn't have been able to walk, so I wore leg braces until I was 8 years old. And I ended up really isolated. And I don't know if I just refused to go play with the other kids or if my parents didn't make me. And so I didn't interact with a lot of people when I was really young. You know, I was hidden away. And so I spent a lot of time by myself. I did a lot of reading, spent a lot of time in fantasy. And I've heard other stories in here that, you know, I think some pretty horrible things happened to me as a kid. And I listen to other people's stories, and it's like, yeah, that was Tuesday, you know? But it was pretty horrible for me. And I really envy people that liked their grandparents, because I didn't like any of them, you know? My maternal grandfather was a fundamentalist Christian preacher who was a rageaholic. And his method of preaching the Bible was to strip out all the love and forgiveness and talk about fire and brimstone. And even at a really young age, that didn't work for me. And I never had one single conversation of any depth at all with my grandmother on that side of the family. Now, my other side of the family, my father's mother was... She was short and slender, quiet. She had a lot of the visible Native American heritage, because I'm part Cherokee and it comes from that side of the family. So she had the dark skin and the dark eyes and the dark hair. And my father went out and married a man who was tall and blonde and full-bodied and gregarious. He went out and married the woman most unlike his mother he could find, which I think is an indication of my father's basic mental health. You know, so and my grandmother never forgave my mother for that. She hated her. Now, I'm the oldest of four, and two of my siblings are colored like my dad. They're, you know, they have the dark skin and the dark hair and the dark complexion and the dark eyes. And then my sister and I looked like my mother. And my grandmother hated me. And I had no idea why. You know, I understand it now. It still pisses me off, but I mean, I understand it. You know, so I really envy people that like their grandparents, because I didn't. And so I've heard a lot of people say this. It's like everybody else got the instruction book and I didn't know what the hell I was doing, you know, and I didn't know how to interact with people. I got progressively more miserable as I got older, and went to school, and I was I'm really good at taking tests. So I did really well in school, but I didn't do well socially. I didn't. And I had my first drink when I was 16. And it was a beer, and I threw about half of it away. And that was the last time I ever did that. And I never went out on a date in high school. I never asked anybody out on a date in high school. And it took me years sober to figure out that there was a connection between those two things. And so I ended up doing a lot of camping, which meant that a friend would pick me up in the van and we'd go get blitzed all weekend long, you know, on whatever was there. And you know the fisheye lens they have of people when they fall over, you know, and things get really big? That happened to me. It's not really all that cool. It hurts. And I was the only thing that kept me under control is that I just didn't, couldn't get away from my family. And then I went to college, and my roommate there taught me how to drink. He was 21. It was great. And I remember, like, one night, one afternoon, I'm walking home to my dorm, and there was this huge, giant oak tree in the middle of the yard. I'm like, there's some poor fool passed out under the tree. I get closer, I'm like, damn, it's my roommate passed out under the tree. And so I had to carry him up the stairs, and he finished off a pony keg by himself. He also wouldn't throw up, so he was out. He was poisoned for like weeks. And he taught me well. After a couple of years there, I ended up transferring to a school that was closer to my house. And then I took a year's leave of absence in 1978. And one of the things I did during that time was I was a Fuller Rush salesman. And I was actually really good at it, because this was when it was safe to go door to door. And I actually made really good money. Unfortunately, what happened is I'd walk into somebody's house and I'd look around, and after I pitched them, I'd go, "You want to smoke a joint?" And the rest of the day was gone, and I just lost way too many days like that. And then on one Christmas Eve, I took what I now knew to be a geographic cure, because I was just insane and I couldn't take it anymore, and I ended up in Denver. And I didn't have any money, so before I left, I went to the ATM and I put an empty envelope in, and I told it I'd made a $200 deposit. And I had a $100 limit, so I withdrew $100 at LM59 and another $100 at 1201 and left the state. And I ended up in Denver, and I hate cold weather. And I immediately lost my car, and I did some things I'm not really proud of, although I'm no longer ashamed of them, to survive. But I did survive. But I also got more and more insane and started having blackouts. And I remember going to a concert, and there's 40,000 people in this thing, and I felt completely alone. And, I always wondered why the people that drank like me always said they were going to die before they were 30, and after I sober up, I realized it's because they drank like I did. When your favorite drink is a kamikaze and it's named for a suicidal act, God's trying to tell you, trying to get your attention. And there were moments even that I remember. I was one of these people, when I went to a party, I would just sit on the floor anyway because I was going to get there, and it was just simpler. And I remember this woman at this party who was sober. And I couldn't believe it. And I kept talking to her and said, "You know, you're okay. You don't." And she just smiled and laughed. I have no idea if she's a friend of Bill W. or not. but it, you know, it's just one of those things that happened. And then something wonderful happened, which is what happened next. And miracles happened. You know, when people think about miracles, they think of Christ walking on water. You know, and I'd love to walk on water. I would. But when Christ walked on water, he had to, because his friends were on the boat and they were terrified and he had to go get to them. If I walk on the water, it's because I want CNN to go, "Man walks on water." It's just not the same. There's a divine economy that doesn't allow that to happen. And when I wake up sober and alive in the morning, that's two miracles. And they're really much more practical miracles than walking on water. And if I interact with God and with nature and other people, other miracles follow. One of the things I heard a televangelist say, I was channel surfing, and I just stopped and listened to him. He said, he's talking about miracles, and he said, people are so concerned with the spectacular that they overlook the supernatural. And there's lots of little miracles through my day. So what happened is I got arrested because that $200, I never managed to pay it back. And so I got stopped by the cops one night and got extradited back to Arkansas eventually. And I say I went back to Arkansas kicking and screaming, but it's not true because I was in leg chains and waist chains and handcuffs. I didn't think I went through DTs until I realized that that Calvary troop that went through my jail cell probably wasn't real. And it took me a while. A lot of my realizations come after something happens. So I eventually got extradited to the Benton County Jail in Arkansas. And they gave me a choice between going to treatment and going to prison. And I couldn't decide. And people think I'm joking, but no, I really couldn't decide. And I want to explain just how insane this is. The prison I would have been sent to is Tucker. They made a movie about it called Brubaker with Robert Redford. And there's all this torture and, you know, escaped prisoners whose bodies are later found in the yard. And they had a thing called the Tucker telephone. And with an old-fashioned crank phone, what you're doing is you're generating the electricity to make the call. So they put you in a soundproof room and tie you down and run wires from the telephone. And they took one up to your neck and one up to what I consider to be a really private part of somebody's anatomy. And then he'd make a 30-minute call, talk to his girlfriend. Now, see, I knew all this, and I still couldn't decide. And my attorney finally said, "Dwight, go to treatment. If you want to go to prison afterwards, we'll arrange it for you." So that's how I ended up in treatment. Now, and that's that. It was a really long, slow process. I did a lot of my heavy-duty thinking lying awake in my bunk at night. And a couple months into the treatment, which is actually like about 6 months physically sober, it finally dawned on me that I was indeed an alcoholic. That I finally conceded to my innermost self that I wasn't like other people and I wouldn't be. And that for me to drink was to die. And it wasn't going to be all that long. You know, I weigh like 185 pounds right now. When I came in, I weighed 120. I didn't eat. You know, I wanted to be unconscious. And I was really good at being unconscious. And so I was terrified. Because that shell had finally broken down. And I said the Serenity Prayer and the 23rd Psalm over and over and over until I finally got to sleep. And the next day, the compulsion to drink was gone. I didn't realize it until much later, but it was gone. And I was able to focus on all of the other grave emotional mental disorders I have. And so, and it hasn't returned. Except for very briefly, that one time after my car caught on fire at a gas station. And it was just... And it, even then, it was just momentarily. So, and I... And then I met my sponsor, a guy named Jim B., who's still alive and kicking. He's 80 now. And if there's one person who's responsible for me being sober and for the quality of my sobriety, it's Jim. And Julie, my beloved, and I just got a new dog. And we got him from the pound. And she's sort of like, well, you really know how to treat this animal. You know what he needs. And it's like, I know what a wounded animal needs. And Jim did too. And he was amazing. He was minus half a leg because he was drunk and wrapped a van around a telephone pole. And he knew what to do about that. He never drove a van again. You know? And he owned a sign company, and if he had charged me rent, he wouldn't have had to paint a sign. He just let me stay there. And he took me to meetings. And it was a small enough town that if you wanted to go and see different people, you had to drive 30 minutes. So he picked me up, and we have a meeting before the meeting and the meeting afterwards. And it was just... And it was good. He was so gentle, and he was always encouraging. He was always helping me out. And he did things, too. Like, he told me rule number 62. He wouldn't tell me where it was. He told me it was in the 12 and 12. And it was a small enough town that nobody else would tell me. Nobody else would tell me where it was, either. So I had to read the 12 and 12 to find it. He told me there are 144 musts in the third edition of the Big Book. I know where all of them are. Yeah, and some of them aren't important, but some of them are, we must be rid of the selfishness. We must, or it kills us. Once more, at certain times, the alcoholic has no effective mental defense against the first drink. His defense must come from a higher power. I remember the first time I was in my halfway house, which came later, when I was in my halfway house, and I was out on a pass. I had money in my pocket. It was the first time in months that I could have actually bought a drink. And there's a liquor store right there. And I went, oh, God, I can't do that. And I didn't. I walked right on by it. And... He taught me so much. And some of it he took from Joe and Charlie. And if you guys have never heard Joe and Charlie's talk, you really ought to. But one of the few things I can claim is that I heard the original Joe and Charlie live. And he told me that when it's in the discussion about resentment, he says that we don't go crazy. We don't drink and go crazy. We go insane, and then we drink again. You know, it says the insanity of alcohol returns, and we drink again. And he also told me that the good Lord looks over drunks and fools, and I'd had double coverage all my life. Yeah, so it wasn't always too serious. And he was the man that I did my fourth and fifth step with. And the only way I could do... The only way I could write my fourth step was to make an appointment to do my fifth step, because I was just terrified of it. And it was for noon on Saturday, and I'm still writing it at 11:59. But it was fine. It was exactly what I needed to do. And I start off with the thing I was most ashamed with, and he said, yeah, I did that too. It just got easier. And in my original big book, beside the discussion of the fifth step, I wrote, "Welcome to the human race," because I was finally part of. And it felt so good, and it still feels good to feel that. And his wife was an amazing woman too. I was, she was one of these people that would, she was a prim and proper English teacher, so when she used the F word, people just, and she would say outrageous things. And one of my favorites was, I was at a meeting at Jim's shop, and there was me and Jim, his wife, and a couple other people. We were talking about conceptions of God. And Jim was talking about God being this old white guy, long beard, you know, and all this. And, you know, Northwest Arkansas, God's an old white guy, long white beard. And I know he's doing it to protect me and his wife off, because he knows better. I know his spirituality. I know his story. He's just poking fun at me, basically. And I'm just about to raise my hand and start talking about Buddhism in the Eightfold Way when Reba pops up with, "This is ridiculous. Everyone knows God is a black lesbian." And I lost it. And the other guys in there were doing the fish out of water thing now, where it went very rapidly from, you know, "Oh, if God's not a black lesbian, she's probably not a white man either." You know? And she destroyed worldviews. And she I don't know if they stayed changed or not, but they were changed for that moment. And I don't tell other people's stories much, but there's one of my favorites is that I am going to tell is I knew this guy in the Rogers group of AA who came in, and they told him to read the story, which was then entitled Dr. Alcoholic Addict, because it was a third edition. They told him to read page 449, and he thought that he had to like everything because he wasn't really ready yet. And so he went out and got drunk, and he came back in, he bought himself another big book, and he ripped page 449 out. And I just love that. It's like, yeah, that's, you know, whatever works. After I'd been sober for a couple of years, I was out at Beaver Lake, which is a man-made lake by my parents in Northwest Arkansas, and it's I was out with my family, and my siblings were drinking rum and cola by pouring out some cola, putting the rum in. And I'd made really sure that I kept good track of my can, and I was drinking Coke. And I set it down, and I turned around, and I picked it back up, and I thought, this got warm really quick. And I took a slug, and it was a rum and cola, and I couldn't swallow it. My throat locked up. I spit it out. I reacted exactly the same way I did when I was siphoning gasoline out for the lawnmower and got some of that in my mouth. And, you know, and it's like a couple of years ago, I couldn't not drink. And this, I couldn't physically put alcohol in my system. And I'm so grateful for that. And it's such a radical change. You know, and I have story upon story like that. And God is always there. Gracious. So, after I had a couple of years of being sober, I got really depressed because I was finally starting to feel all those things that I'd been numbing for all these years. And I decided to want to kill myself. And I wanted to do it in a way that wouldn't look like suicide, because that would be even more painful for my parents. I just wanted it to be over. And so I used to attend this really good meeting in Eureka Springs, Arkansas, which is in the Ozark Mountains, and there's lots of 200-foot drops. And I thought, no, I'll just go to that meeting one day and go over one of those 200-foot drops, and they'll say he died sober on his way to a meeting. And I knew that I wouldn't want to do that on the way back, because it was a really good meeting. I'd feel too good to want to kill myself on the way back. So one night, I'm coming home from that meeting. It's been raining. I hit a wet spot at the beginning of an S-curve, and I end up with my left front wheel over one of those 200-foot drops. And I changed my mind. I don't mean I reversed the decision. I changed my mind. I realized that I didn't want to die. I wanted to stop hurting. I didn't want to die. And I haven't been like that since. And that's what Spirit has to do sometimes to get my attention. Because I can be really stubborn. And after about 12 years, I had flashbacks about being molested as a child, which made a lot of things make sense to me, which is why I got into therapy. And therapy really helped me. There are things that 12-step can't do for me. And I remember talking to my therapist once, and I was complaining. I'd been complaining and complaining. She finally said, you know, if the tables were turned, what would you tell, you know, if you were the therapist and you heard this, what would you tell? And I'd say, I found myself saying, I'd find a 12-step group for the problem. And she opened up a drawer and handed me a meeting list. And so so that was another stage of my recovery. And I qualified for a lot of different 12-step groups. And basically, the more abused you are as a kid, the more addictions you will have as an adult. And I've read that, and it seems to be true as far as I can tell. And I can tell you that the first step sucks. It doesn't matter how many times you take it; it still sucks because it still hurts. Because you still have to admit you're powerless, and you still have to go through pain. You know, the only advantage of working the 12 steps the first time, you know it works. You know that there's light at the end of the tunnel. And I eventually moved out of Arkansas and ended up at one point in Tulsa. And I had a basement apartment in Tulsa, and there was a flood. And I wake up about 12:30, and I reach down, and the floor's wet, and I go, that's not good. And so I'm really calm, so I get everything as high up as I can, and it doesn't look like it's really going to overwhelm me. It's just, you know, so I just wait the storm out. It's like, I'm perfectly okay. And now, the next week, a woman stood me up for lunch, and I went ballistic. It's not like I had any more control over her than I did the water. And so I need to learn. I always need to learn these things and to keep them in mind. And this is how I learned them. And I've done a lot of things as far as employment goes in sobriety. I actually owned a personal care home. I've done some real estate investing. But unfortunately, I chose the wrong partner in the personal care home, and then when I got divorced, I sort of lost the real estate investment. And I'm really good at survival jobs, and I've never connected what I do for a living for what I do to live. Because I spend a lot of time, and particularly early on, in 12-step giving back, you know, and I'm really grateful to do that. But I eventually, you remember I took a year's leave of absence in 78. I eventually went back to school in 98. And I got a degree in anthropology from Georgia State. And one of the things I did as an anthropology student is I did a vision quest. And a vision quest is a Native American tradition where you go out and try to determine what you need to do with your life. And I did have a vision, and I saw the face of an old Indian man in the clouds. And at the time, I thought that meant that I was, that's where I needed to look for my spirituality. Because it is in the Native American tradition, since I started studying with shaman shortly afterwards. And it did. That transformed my life. Visions transform your life. Hallucinations don't. You know, the cavalry troop in the jail cell didn't do anything for me. But this did. And I ended up actually finding a church that I liked. They call it the Friends Meeting, but I go to so many meetings, I call it a church. Just to keep them. And I went there, and I immediately felt at home. And I hadn't felt at home in a church in a really long time. And I met a woman named Loretta there, who many people here will probably remember. And we went, I met her at the Quaker meeting, and then we went to eat lunch at the same place without consulting one another. We just sort of ended up at the same place, and we started talking. And after about half an hour, it was really apparent that we had a friend named Bill Wilson in common. You know? And she invited me to go to the 7:30 group, which is how I started attending there. And then I got separated from my wife and attended there quite a bit. Because after 33 years, I don't attend meetings as often as I used to. But when I get stressed, I do. Because they really help. So that's what it was like. And what it's like now. Well, right at the moment, I'm telling my story at NABBA. Yeah. And, yeah, that's a joke, but it's also, it's being in the moment. I'm convinced there's no ego in the moment, and that's where you find God. And nobody spends all their time there, nobody I know of. You know. But the more time I spend there, the better off I am. And that reminds me of a one day at a time story I'm going to tell. This happened quite a while back. I was stopping to use a payphone, which will give you some idea how long it's been. And so I'm making my phone call, and this guy drives up and parks beside in the parking lot, and he has a one day at a time license plate. So he gets out of the truck, and I go, "Hey, you a friend of Bill W?" And he goes, "Does he live around here?" And after a couple of minutes of really disjointed conversation, I said, "Well, you know, Bill Wilson started AA, and that's an AA slogan." And he said, no, I'm just a good Christian man. I've been trying to live this way for 40 years." So, you know, we don't have a monopoly on it. And sometimes I think we do. And I learned a lot by being in nature and being with animals. And a couple of months ago, we had to put a really good friend of ours down, and he was a 16-year-old dog, and one of the hardest things I ever had to do. And the way that I did that is I came to the 7:30 because we had an appointment to put him down that day, and I came in and talked about it. And everybody came up to me and said, "Yeah, I did that, cried my eyes out. And I did that, and I cried my eyes out." But he taught me so much. A couple of years ago, we were at Stone Mountain. And because of a clerical error, Julie and I and Buddy had an entire campground to ourselves. They accidentally put us in a closed campground, and rather than move us, they just opened it up. And Buddy loved that, you know, 'cause he got to run around. And so one night during that weekend, we're up there and we're taking our showers, and he's outside waiting for us. And we walk back, and he gets lost on the way back because he's old. And he's blind, pretty much deaf. And And we get back to the campfire, and we're sort of assuming he's just going to shuffle along, and he never comes up. And then we hear this pitiful howling, and he's back up at the last place he saw us, which is the comfort station, and just howling mournfully. So we go up there and apologize to him, and I put him on a leash and take him back. And as soon as I put him on the leash, he's okay. It's like, oh, good. You know, and the 12 steps are my leash. You know, and I can go off leash, and sometimes I'm okay. But if I stay, you know, if I stay leashed to God, I'm much better off. And my life today is about being able to help other people. One of my friends from my church was talking to me, and turns out her brother's a really severe alcoholic, and I go, I've been sober for 25 years. No. And so I start talking to her, and at one point I'm reading her the story, which is now called Acceptance is the Answer. And it's a really good story. Yeah. And I have read other stories in the big book, I promise. But so I'm reading the story, and then her brother comes in, and so I start over from the first. And her brother and I are laughing hysterically because it's really funny if you're an alcoholic. If you're the Al-Anon, it's not funny at all. She got more and more pissed off as the story went on. Yeah. And the really nice thing is I was able to buy him a big book, and he eventually got into treatment. And you know that where it says in the doctor's opinion that, you know, this man sobered up and you didn't recognize him. That happened to me, because this man sat next to his sister at church, and I was across from him for an hour and a half, and I didn't know who he was, because he had changed so much, you know, because he was smiling. And he's, you know, he's 6'3", and he wasn't crouching down. He wasn't slouching. And it's wonderful to see transformations like that. You know? And I love the 7:30. I get to, you know, and I love having a home group. Because, you know, I can say things like to the person who came in through Al-Anon, I can look up at her one day and say, you know, the last time I was here, you weren't an alcoholic. and she can laugh at that. Yeah. And I know that this person got a promotion. You know, I know this person is dealing with cancer. This person, you know, I know these things. It's my community. Yeah. And it's a place where people know me. And a couple of years ago, I was looking for a new shaman to work with, and I was given a brochure about a man named Peter Calhoun, who's a truly amazing person. Unfortunately, he's passed on, but. And I talked to him on the phone, and the next stage was to go up and interview him. And he lived in Townsend at the time, and I did that. And I was sitting across from him at a restaurant. And you remember the old man I told you about, the face I saw on the vision quest? It was his face. Yeah. So I took that as a sign that I was supposed to work with him. Yeah. And I have become a shaman. And that's my spiritual path. That's my calling. That's what I can do to give back to the world. And it took me years to get over the fear of saying, yes, I'm this. I can do this. You know, and to claim this. And I can help people. It's wonderful. Peter taught me these healing techniques. They're so simple and so profound that, you know, that things vanish that had been there for years. And you know, I did a workshop this weekend, and I helped a woman grieve her father, and she hadn't grieved for a year. He's been dead for a year, and she did by the end of it, but because I could open it up, because I knew because I made the space, the sacred space for that to happen. And another woman forgave her mother. And another woman stepped into her power. And I can do this. And I can do this because I've been in these rooms. Because I did what you guys told me. That, you know, what I help people do is have a direct contact with spirit, which sounds a lot like the 11th step when you think about it. You know? And it's wonderful to do this, and it's wonderful to making a living doing something I love to do. And I can't quit my day job yet, you know, but I'm working there, and I'm getting there. And so what it's like now is really good. You know, any time I was drinking, over any considerable period, my life got worse. It got more insane. It got crazier. And when I practice the program, it gets better. Over any considerable period, my life gets better. And I call them the negative promises on page 52. We're having trouble with personal relationships. It couldn't be that. I use that and I balance it off against the promises, the 9-step promises. And I can see where my life is. And if my life isn't working, then I have a simple kit of spiritual tools that I can pick up. And I'm sort of bummed about the Falcons season. You know? But I can go to a Falcons game today, and I'm part of that. I'm part of that crowd. It's not like when I was drinking and I was surrounded by thousands of people and I was alone. I'm part of it, you know. And so, yeah, this year we get to share the misery, but I'm part of that, you know. And that's good. I'm part of AA. I'm part of the Quaker community. And I'm part of all these things because I'm alive. And I'm alive because of 12 steps. I'm alive because people love me. And I'm so intently grateful that I was asked to do this. Because I get to remember this. I don't think about what it was like very often anymore. You know, but it's really good for me to remember just how insane I was. And just how much better my life is now. And I was talking to somebody the other day. I said, well, you know, I've got a good woman and a good dog, a good truck. He said, that's all you need. And I want a little more than that, but that's really good stuff. You know? And it's things I didn't have. You know, I didn't know anything about love before I came in here. I didn't know that I was worth anything. I thought I was a miserable piece of shit. You know, my primary memory of the last couple of years of my drinking is wanting to rip my skin out because I just couldn't stand being myself anymore. And nowadays I like what I see. I can look in the mirror. And if I screw up, I can say I forgive myself. No, let me take that back. When I screw up, I can forgive myself. Because I make mistakes all the time. I always think we should give the person's significant other a couple of minutes at the end just to rebuttal. But I'm really glad we're not doing that. Because it's a lot easier to work my program at 7:30 in the morning on Saturday. And one of my great joys in my life is going to the 7:30 meeting on Saturday, because afterwards they serve breakfast downstairs. And there's a group of us that get together, and you might have noticed that I don't really work in my mind doesn't work in a linear fashion. And it just goes, the conversation goes. It can be song lyrics, it can be, and it's silliness, but it's fun. And it's, you know, it's the people after a shipwreck. You know, who are just giddy with excitement over surviving it, only that the shipwreck's always out there. You know, I don't have to drink anymore. You know, I used to, and I'm so grateful for that because my life changed. You know, and you know, it's one person talking to another. You know, that's what it boils down to. Meetings are great. Speaker meetings are great. It's one person talking to another, and that's where the miracles happen. And it's 9 o'clock. I think I'll stop. Thanks.
Great. Thanks a lot. That was awesome. A lot of good stuff here.
The monkey, we're going to have a show. We're going to do a little thing and call a Coca-Cola.